You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Connection Between the Living and the Dead. It is Collected Works, Volume 168, 8 lectures translated by Aria Jackson. This is Lecture 5, entitled Karmic Effects, given in Zurich on October 24, 1916. What spiritual science has to say about life and about the structure of the spiritual worlds is to be found through knowledge of the objective facts into which human beings can be led by corresponding capabilities. We are indeed familiar with all of this. Thus, if the issue is to justify or defend spiritual science in the world today, we cannot base our defense on anything other than indicating how people come to insight into the spiritual worlds by developing certain capacities, and then explaining how these capabilities arise from a corresponding formation of living relationships in the spiritual worlds. An objection based on human wishes or desires can never be made in relation to the facts that come to light in this way, although it is often almost a matter of course. It is still good to point this out. Just as little could an objection be made in relation to the facts of the physical world which are observed with the senses. Although this is obvious, one often hears objections to certain spiritual scientific statements, objections that stem directly from human wishes or desires. Something along the lines of, quote, "If spiritual science has that to say about the spiritual worlds, then I do not wish to become familiar with spiritual science, because if it really were so in the spiritual worlds, I could never get used to such a form of the spiritual worlds." Close quote. As fundamentally absurd as such an objection is, it has been said. But it appears not only in this very obviously absurd form. It also appears masked in all sorts of dismissive attitudes that are held in relation to spiritual science. Even if some insight or other of spiritual science could never be supported by the claim that the world had only one meaning, that the spiritual world were like such and such, one can nevertheless know how things really are in the spiritual world. One can never say anything about the structure of the spiritual worlds based on such assumptions, but on the basis of real insight, one can turn it upside down and indicate what spiritual science and its results can mean for human life. 2 weeks ago, I demonstrated for a particular subject what the spiritual scientific ethos means specifically for our time in relation to the great challenges of this age. Today I would like to make a few other points that will go somewhat more deeply into what spiritual science can be for humanity, and in particular, what it can be today for those who will study it more deeply. I would also like to point out the resistances spiritual science can meet from today's culture, and which resistances one must be armed against. The spiritual abilities that lead spiritual scientists to see into the facts of the spiritual world develop gradually, in a way that has often been described, in a way such that one first comes to know the major facts of spiritual life, those that are the essential facts with respect to the evolution of earthly life, to repeated earthly lives, to life between death and rebirth, and so on. Then it is absolutely possible to speak correctly, not only of these general, major viewpoints, of these general truths, but also to speak of certain special truths. And when we become more and more familiar with such special truths, then spiritual science becomes more valuable for the individual, concrete human life. Human life must at first be an enigma for outer physical view, because if it were not an enigma, human beings would not be subject to a development that makes us ever more capable. Our abilities, which are produced especially in connection with the soul, must come from our own efforts. They grow out of our efforts. In the spiritual realm, our efforts make us mature through the energy that we devote to solving the riddle of the world. By devoting energy to solving this riddle, our strengths are fortified. We become ever more capable in life, and we truly become perfected also within humanity's evolution. We need not worry about that life will lose its interest for us when someone partially solves the riddle posed by the physical world and is able to look into the spiritual world, because life poses riddles in every realm. Upon entering the spiritual world, one finds still other riddles of life. We also gain something in relation to the physical world, specifically from the experiences we have solved. From the experiences we have solving certain human and life riddles from within the spiritual world. We gain trust and experience through the solving of the deeper human and world riddles that are revealed only in the spiritual world itself. One particular riddle is what human beings experience between birth and death as destiny. A great deal is packed into this word destiny. Yesterday in the public lecture, we were able to touch on how the matter of destiny is resolved through repeated earth lives. Those are general viewpoints, but we can also talk of specific circumstances. Let us take as an example someone losing a dear relative. Let us say that the relative dies at a young age, so that the one who remains behind has a long time on earth to pass through without this relative. By quickening such a thought within ourselves, we see at once before our spiritual sight that this is a matter of destiny for many people. Now the point is that spiritual science can truly shed light on such a matter of destiny. Certainly each case is fundamentally different. But precisely by studying individual cases in a spiritual, scientific way, we can have a glimpse into the mysterious course of human life. One could, for instance, consider the following experience. A person dies young, is taken away from his or her relatives. Yesterday I said that the relationships that have developed between these people, by their coming into contact with one another here through their physical bodies, are much more extensive than what is expressed through those physical bodies. A much wider circle of unity develops when two people have lived together 10, 20, 30, or 40 years. A much wider circle of forces develops between the two people than can unfold within the physical world in those years. When we turn a spiritual, scientific eye to such relationships, we then often see that what connects with the relationship requires, through its inner nature, continuation. The one who remains behind here must bear the loss. If we express it abstractly, this person has physically lost sight of a dear human being unexpectedly, and the hopes for a life together here in the physical world are torn away as a result. The foundations for life together have been cut off. This is all part of life experience, but it is also part of what is, as it were, added to the experiences we share together in the physical body. The fact that sorrow and pain follow our experiences together in the physical body affects in the relationships that could have begun only in the physical body. Just as what we experience of each other daily, when we face each other in physical bodies, pours forth into the karmic line, into the advancing stream of evolution, so too is what we experience under the impression of loss added to what we experience daily. All experiences and feelings we experience are added to the accumulation of experiences we have in life in the physical body. This is looking from the viewpoint of the one who remains behind in the physical world. The viewpoint of the one who has crossed into the spiritual world is somewhat different. after crossing into the spiritual world, the one who has crossed is no less present with the person who was left behind. Indeed, it is clear to those who are truly able to investigate the spiritual worlds, in specific cases such as these, that for the one who has crossed over, the conscious togetherness with those who have remained behind is a more intensive, more inner togetherness than could have existed in the physical body. But one sees that very often this increased inner togetherness is there to properly complete the circle of changing relations that formed here in the physical world. Through true positive investigation, one often makes the following discovery. One sees that people have met here in physical life, and through this a certain circle of unified interests has formed under the threshold of consciousness. Given the conditions of their lives, if these people had been together here in the physical world for a longer time, the relationships that would have developed on the basis of karma would not have been able to be deepened intensely enough. For those remaining behind, with whom the departed had been close, the one who passes through death's gate can often bring about a karmically necessary deepening during their remaining time on earth. A deepening that could not have been brought about through circumstances of life had the departed soul not passed through death's gate. The one who has passed is now with the thoughts of those souls on earth, penetrates, flows through the thoughts of those souls. Thus correct fulfillment of karma often involves pain born on this side, and on the other side an intensive togetherness with the thoughts of the ones who remain behind. One other thing results if we follow the second soul, the one who will pass through the gate of death at a later time, as that soul enters into relationship with the one who died earlier. We notice that much is arranged differently according to the difference in time between the two deaths. When we enter the spiritual world, it is not the same to meet a person who died at the same time we did, to take this extreme case, as one who died 15 years earlier. If the one we meet has already spent a certain time in the spiritual world, then the experiences he has had in the meantime are now in the soul that we meet, and so that soul affects us in a different way. A karmic bond is made accordingly that could not have been made in the same way through other conditions. We must see all of what we experience in this way with a person who is close to us as being completely based on our karmic relationship. I have said many times that even if this knowledge cannot assuage sorrow and pain, for us to know what happens when everything fits together, what happens when everything interacts, it still must be said from a certain viewpoint that life takes on its true meaning only when seen as a whole in this way. The point is that we develop all the relationships in which we find ourselves during a human life, so that not only this life, quote, comes into its own, close quote, so to speak, but also all the contributions that we must make in the following earth lives for this earthly evolution come into their own. What is begun with the painful loss of a relative or a friend or any other person close to us will appear in its continued effects in the next earthly life. And in a certain way, all of these effects are already contained in their causes. No loss occurs in human life that does not correspondingly put us in the correct succession of earth lives. Perhaps this will not give relief from our pain in specific cases, but from this viewpoint we will become able to reclaim an understanding of life. By talking about such things, we can learn something directly from looking at actual cases. Another specific case that I would like to mention is the ending of a person's life through misfortune. One can presume from the outset that there is a great difference between the case of a life ending by a person's being run over by a railway train or dying of unnatural causes in some other violent way, and the case of a life's being complete at an old age or ending because of illness. One can further make the presumption that there must be a difference between a life ended early by illness and a life that ends at an old age. Now, of course, each detail of these cases is different, but we can also find certain clues in them. Above all, we can ask ourselves what a violent death is. This question can be answered only if we look at death not from here, from physical earth life. We must look at it from the other side, where those who have passed through the gate of death look at it. I have mentioned in lectures, which have in fact already been published, that seeing death from the other side, from the side the dead enter through death's gate, is the most important experience, and shows the discarnate person how life triumphs evermore. The direct vision of death from the other side, which is sublime, which is grand, which is always there, also means that a constant I consciousness exists in us between death and rebirth. As our memory, which brings us back to a certain point in physical life, gives us I consciousness here, so too does the vision of death from the other side, the spiritual side, give us I consciousness between death and rebirth. Now, how is it when this vision of death is affected by the fact that a violent end of life caused the death? Seen from the other side, a violent end of life is an experience, a perception, of the most far-reaching kind. As strange as it may sound, when one investigates these things, the following emerges. The ways in which the circumstances of time affect the experiences of the soul are much different in the spiritual worlds, which we enter through death's gate, than they are here, though some conditions here are reminiscent of what occurs in a much more extensive way between death and rebirth. In order to explain what this depends on, I will resort to a comparison that results only when one knows the corresponding facts from the spiritual world. You are certainly aware that we can have experiences in a short period of time here in physical life, perhaps in the course of a day or a few hours, that mean much more to us than other experiences that we have had over a long period of time. Many can recall such an event from their own lives here in the physical world, one that happened in perhaps a very short amount of time, but brought more consequential inner experiences than the events of entire months or years. People often express it in this way, quote, "I will never forget what I experienced then," close quote. Very often what I have just characterized is hidden behind this simple phrase. Now it is true that the impression of their earth life that discarnate souls receive from a death, caused relatively quickly or perhaps in an instant by the outer world, that had nothing to do with their own organism, compresses itself for the life between death and a new birth and becomes just as rich as what could be achieved in a longer earthly life, perhaps even in decades of earthly life. I do not mean everything that was experienced in earth life, but certain things that are important as forces for the life between death and rebirth. For those things, what would usually be distributed over a longer period of time can in fact be compressed into an instant, one can say. It is really a much different experience if with one's subconscious one sees death coming, because inner forces assert themselves that cause death from within the organism, or whether death is caused by forces affecting one's organism from outside, having nothing at all to do with the organism itself. Such a death finds its true, real explanation only in the fact that we view it in connection with the entire course of human life through repeated earth lives. You can very easily infer from what I said about the connection between the I consciousness after death and the vision of the death, that the perception of the death itself is something very meaningful for the strength and intensity we have in the I consciousness between death and rebirth. Circumstances that appear to be coincidental from here, from the perspective of physical life, are absolutely not coincidences. They are, rather, contained in a world of necessity. It may appear to be a coincidence here that someone is run over by a railway train, but seen from the other side, from the spiritual side, it is not coincidental. If the question is posed from the other side, from the spiritual side, if I may do so, though of course it can be only for purposes of comparison, quote, how does such a violent death appear in the totality of a human earth life? Close quote. Then we will always find that in the past this person has experienced, through the lives between death and rebirth, and through various circumstances in repeated earth lives up until the unfortunate event, that the I consciousness developed for the purely spiritual world needed strengthening, invigorating. And this invigoration occurred by the person's physical life having been ended, not from within, but from without. So we must reckon with the fact that we are not only related to our surroundings through connections that are caused by conscious forces in the soul. Only in the rarest cases can we know, ordinarily we cannot know, how our subconscious thinks. I have often pointed out to you that thought life does not end at the threshold of consciousness, that human beings continually lead a thought life in the sub, or one could also say in the supraconscious. People cannot think through and assess what this more encompassing consciousness could be for them. One could ask every single person, quote, why haven't you had a mishap today? Close quote. There would have been the possibility for every single one to have had this or that mishap. Sometimes you might halfway realize why a mishap did not occur, but you see the connection only in the rarest cases. One time, you may have a certain disinclination to do something and go somewhere a half hour later than expected, and later notice that something happened along the route that could have happened to you had you gone that half hour earlier. The subconscious was working here, and it delayed you. Such effects of the subconscious are constantly present. They are just not perceptible to human beings. For anyone able to observe the circumstances of the world from a spiritual viewpoint, it is completely clear that those who meet with misfortune were not protected from it by the good genius that takes effect in the subconscious. Rather, they meet misfortune by being driven to it through the necessity of karma. If this misfortune had not occurred, what I described would not have been able to happen. The strengthening of the I consciousness in the way I indicated, which was necessary for them. People live into the circumstances in a certain earth life into which they are placed through birth. However, they live into these circumstances after having observed during the last life between death and rebirth that in a certain way their I lacks strength. A drive to strengthen the I lives within them and leads them to those circumstances that cause their misfortune. You must see the matter in this way. You see from these examples that life gains meaning when we look at it from this viewpoint of spiritual scientific awareness. As I have often pointed out, people do not think enough about the changes that have taken place comparatively recently in our soul evolution. Most, and in particular those who are infected with today's erudition, simply picture the soul life of centuries ago to be the same as today's soul life. That is a completely erroneous idea, as we know. In every detail, the expression and attitude of human soul life has changed significantly. What spiritual science must bring up today from various sources about such life understanding, as I indicated, was present in souls in more of an atavistic clairvoyant way, not so long ago at all. People then had ideas to some extent about the connections in life. But human evolution is pushing forward, and such ideas are dying out. However, because humanity has already partially lost this old connection with the spiritual world in the course of evolution, and will continue to lose more and more of it, it will also be increasingly necessary for people to inform themselves again about their connection to the spiritual world through direct spiritual research. That is why spiritual science has appeared precisely in our time. People did not need it in the past, because humanity was not on such a level of soul evolution. From this time on, it will be necessary for the reasons I gave, and will become ever more necessary. Let us substantiate this assertion as well with certain concrete facts. Today there is only a small number of people who take spiritual science into their souls during life between birth and death. I say spiritual science rather than spiritual research, meaning the imaginations and ideas provided by spiritual science. Through spiritual science, people experience something of the spiritual world here in this life, between birth and death. This is not meaningless for the life that we enter when we pass through death's gate. And in addition, we have a consideration that first came to be true in our time, which I will now address. If we go back to earlier times, we still find an old inheritance of humanity in relation to the connection with the spiritual world. Human beings went through death's gate, and because they already had a certain connection to the spiritual world through ideas, through atavistic clairvoyance and such things, they had some commonality between life in the physical world and the life they entered after they went through death's gate. The fact that people, while on earth, knew something instinctively about the spiritual world caused them to have more than a mere accumulation of the thoughts that were memories of earth life on the other side of death's gate. From our time forward, the singular aspect that will appear more and more in human souls is that people will go through death's gate and remain connected to the earth only through their memories. They will remember their earth life here to some extent, and only by having this earth life in their memory after death are they still connected to earth life. In the strictest, most radical sense, this is the case for modern human beings who cannot take in any ideas about the spiritual world from spiritual science. If we take in such ideas, these ideas will provide something after death that will enable us not only to remember our life, but also to see into our earth life. When we acquire ideas about the spiritual world here, windows from the spiritual world open onto the physical world after death, in a manner of speaking, onto everything that is here in the physical world. Thus we carry certain outcomes from this spiritual science through death's gate. What we acquire from spiritual science is not simply a dead knowledge, but rather life substance. Something that lives on when we pass through death's gate. Yes, this spiritual science, in the sense that I have often mentioned, has powerful life substance by virtue of the fact that because the dead live consciously in our thoughts, we can do something for them because we are part of spiritual science. This is related to what I have often said about reading aloud to the dead. The dead are in our thoughts. They see our thoughts. When we cultivate a spiritual scientific train of thought, that is, when we read something to the dead in thought, or tell something to the dead that we know or think about the spiritual worlds, then the dead are with these thoughts that we address to them through spiritual science. By addressing our thoughts to the dead, a bond of attraction is formed between here and there. Thus, because spiritual science is living, we can effectively send up living strength that gives living nourishment to the dead who are close to us. Thus we see that in this inner way, spiritual science can truly conquer death and transform it into life. A community among the living and the dead, which could otherwise not be formed in such an intensive way in this age, can be formed by filling ourselves here with thoughts taken from spiritual science and extending these thoughts to the dead. Spiritual science is precisely what intervenes in life in a living way, whereas the knowledge that is gained of the physical world through conventional science consists only of thoughts that have meaning for the time between birth and death. Such thoughts will be only memories in the life after death, without having any living effect there. We must really contemplate this difference. One more thing must be taken into account, specifically when we wish to think about the meaning of spiritual science for present and future human spiritual evolution. Not only does what we acquire of spiritual science here, or extend to the dead, make its way from the physical world into the spiritual world, but the spiritual scientific knowledge we attain on earth and carry through death's gate works back in turn upon the earthly world. We should not lose sight of the fact that this earth world is being impoverished little by little of forces which come from the earth itself, and which people develop only during life between birth and death. If no more forces flowed from the spiritual world down to the earth than have already flowed until now, then this earth life would be depleted. It is a grim experience to see how thoughtlessly people already live today, not noticing that earth life is being impoverished little by little. That thoughtlessness, incidentally, is a phenomenon that is a reality not only of human intellectual and cultural life, but also of physical life, which is still so abundant on earth. I have already pointed this out, too, in other places. If you read the wonderful geology book titled The Face of the Earth by Edward Suess, you will find an explanation of how the earth used to be much different in terms of its physical surface, and how the forces that were present many eras ago are no longer present today. The earth's surface is crumbling. What takes place in physical life also takes place in spiritual life. And, as I said, the way people look at the earth, without having any consciousness of it, often looks grim. For spiritual life, when we characterize the path that humanity is following, one has to say that despite the arrogance that infiltrates our time, it turns out that people's thoughts are becoming increasingly lifeless, ever more dead, ever more and more disjointed. People are, of course, proud of their thinking today, and how very learned school teachers often think they are when they explain Plato to their students. Mind you, the wise poet Hebel wrote in his diary that he wanted to write a drama, which, however, was not completed, in which the hero was to have been Plato reincarnated. Plato was punished in school by his teacher because while reading Plato, he cannot understand Plato at all. People will encounter, to a certain extent, a discontinuity in their system of thought if a renewal of this system of thought does not come via thoughts that are born of spiritual scientific insight. As strange as it sounds today, it is true. The intensive power that people need to correctly form thoughts so that they have the constancy of truth weakens, because people are supposed to become independent to attain their own power. Thus I could say that in a manner of speaking, the gods have withdrawn the spirits that earlier inspired our correlation of thoughts. We must bring life back into our thoughts ourselves. But we will bring life into our thoughts only if we are not too arrogant to take up within ourselves the life that can flow from spiritual science. Just as it is with thinking, so it is with feeling, and so it is with the impetus to will. This human impetus to will is going to become more and more obstinate. We could almost use this word for it. Separating ourselves more and more from shared humanity, if this great encompassing impetus of the soul is not inoculated, this impetus of soul that can come to be only through seeing the spiritual connection of physical things. With this, I am telling you serious truths about the development of humanity's future. These truths must be penetrated by those who deal with spiritual science. Spiritual science should not just be dead material that satisfies our curiosity. Rather, spiritual science should be something that aims to intervene in the constellation of things that human beings will encounter in the future. But in this, we must see which systems of forces must weaken and be replaced by others. I said that humanity's earthly forces would weaken if no influx of life comes from the spiritual worlds. What we gain from spiritual scientific knowledge and carry with us through death's gate gives us not only the power to shape our life between death and rebirth, but also the power to enable spiritual forces to come to earth. More and more people who are living on earth must be able to receive what comes down from spiritually permeated souls after they have gone through the gate of death, what they have taken with them and has been transformed in the spiritual worlds. Thus, one way to affect the spiritual world from the physical world, that is, to have an influence on the dead, is by reading aloud to the dead, but by directing thoughts of spiritual science to them. In contrast, a way to affect the physical enrichment of earth evolution is to be receptive to what has been achieved by those souls during their sojourn in the physical world, carried through death's gate, and come down transformed from the spiritual world. This can happen because it is a singular fact that spiritual substance gained in physical life creates a form that undergoes metamorphosis in the spiritual world. The physical world can then receive what has been acquired in this changed form, which flows into the physical world in this metamorphosed form. We work on our own karma for ourselves, so that this karma is fulfilled in repeated earth lives, always between birth and death. But shared human karma is made up of both the currents of life that flow here on earth and the currents of life that stream from the spiritual world. Between death and rebirth, we work on this shared human karma with the powers that we develop beyond our own needs. Thus we see how spiritual science is necessary, how it is necessary that human souls work on it, not for the healing of individual human souls alone, but for the healing of the entire progress of humanity on earth as well. We work on our future earth life from the spiritual world, as I said in the public lecture yesterday, by settling into our hereditary connections through the generations before our birth. But we also participate in preparing for future earth lives what concerns not only ourselves, but also all of humanity. We should very specifically penetrate the thoughts that I am expressing in this way. We should meditate on them because they are the kinds of thoughts that transport us into a vital spiritual and soul relationship with the surrounding world. And now, as a counter-image, I would like to show you how the world today judges what spiritual science discloses, and how the world sides with the disposition that brings about what I described as thoughts drying up, becoming discontinuous, becoming disjointed. This would look different in other areas. Precisely those who often have big words to say today about various issues, and who, through their arrogance, reject every connection with the spiritual world, as these are imparted through spiritual science, contribute directly to this hopeless situation that we already see approaching today, and specifically in regard to the world of thought. Allow me to give an example. Again, a new popular collection has been published, so many popular collections have been published today, through which humanity can experience what people have uncovered in the way of wisdom. They say, quote, "It is a great delight to put oneself in the spirit of the times," close quote, and, quote, "We have made such great progress," close quote. There is a great deal of such material today. I want to point out to you a small volume from the collection on the questions of religion today. These questions of religion are treated quite peculiarly. First, arrogantly claiming all today's wisdom, they show how people cannot be satisfied if they are able to believe only what natural science investigates, if they thus have only a naturalistic philosophy. And then they show how people cannot declare themselves to be satisfied with reaching what the editor of this little book calls their religious philosophy, if they have a purely moral philosophy. This religious professional criticizes in a very sharp way the pure philosophy yielded by moral demands. He claims that the pessimism into which much in our time is degenerating is not ungrounded. It comes from a living tragedy of life itself. This was actually experienced in every time period. And this religious professional calls attention to the way that pessimism has asserted itself over knowledge in different time periods. People believe that through their thinking they can come to realize that one cannot know anything, that striving for knowledge can basically never be satisfied. As an example, he actually cites important sources that we should certainly listen to, such as Pliny the Elder, the great Roman natural scientist, who said, quote, "Humans are beings full of contradictions, the unhappiest of all creatures. Other creatures have no needs beyond the limits of nature, but humans are full of infinite wishes and needs that cannot be satisfied. Their nature is a lie, the greatest misery along with the greatest arrogance. In the face of such ill, the best that God has granted humans is the ability to take their own lives." Close quote. Such sayings can be cited from many, many people. Seneca, the wise Seneca, says, for example, quote, "Many learned people are tired of always seeing and doing the same things. They don't exactly hate life, but they have a feeling of disgust about it, which is increasingly gaining ground under the influence of philosophy. They ask how much longer will it always be the same. This unbearable inevitability of getting up and going to bed, of being full and getting hungry, of being cold and becoming warm again, nothing has an end. Everything is part of an unending circle. Everything is fugitive and pursuer at once. Day follows night, night follows day. Summer flows into fall, fall must give way to winter, and even winter's might is broken. Everything goes in order to come back. I see nothing new. I do nothing new of which I do not become weary." Close quote. So said the wise Roman philosopher Seneca. Our religious professional believes some truth to be in it, but this is less interesting to him. Then he calls attention to the pessimism that has come about by people's surrendering more to their feelings. For example, he claims that is where Buddhist pessimism comes from. Quote, "Life is suffering," close quote. They look at life and add up the suffering and pain, the ill, and on the other hand add up the happiness and joy. The former is greater, thus they are pessimists. They look at life overall as an evil. Schopenhauer and Edward von Hartmann did so as well. Again, our religious professional believes that people have good reason for this, but that too does not interest him further. He is more interested in ethically based pessimism. He says that it is completely warranted to look at life without being able to penetrate it with what we call, quote, "God's kingdom," close quote, with what we call the essence of religious confession. And thus our religious professional states two things. One is that human beings select the challenge of being bound to follow a moral law, either in the sense of Kant or Schleiermacher, a law that is very seriously obligating. But on the other hand, human beings are subject to their nature, their drives, tendencies, and desires. And now our religious professional states that human beings can never completely overcome these drives and desires, but they should follow moral law, Moral law gives strict commands. A conflict will inevitably ensue. It must be present in life, and it is. This is warranted pessimism. One must interpret life pessimistically if it is looked at only from the standpoint of ethical challenges. This is life seen from the standpoint of ethical challenges. How humans are situated between these ethical challenges and their natural life. But even when we look at individual ethical obligations, we will see how pessimism is warranted, because according to this religious professional, people often feel that they are in the middle of ethical conflicts in decisive situations. Our professional cites such ethical conflicts for important personalities. Allow me to read just one example. Luther, says our religious professional, quote, who recognized his destiny as no other has, and saw right before his eyes the path he had to follow for the reformation of the church and of people, got into this dilemma, close quote. He calls the incompatibility of obligations a dilemma, quote, at the moment when he was confronted with the question of whether he should approve or reject Philip I of Hesse's double marriage. You see, this was the most difficult of all conflicts for him. If he rejected this marriage and acted in the pure interest of human dignity, then he would have to abandon one of his most important achievements on the path to fulfilling his reformative destiny. Close quote. Because if he had not approved this double marriage, the magnanimous ruler would not have accepted him any more, and according to this religious professional, nothing would have come of the Reformation. Quote, however, if he allowed the marriage, and thus left this one way open, then he must have said to himself that it would be a thorn in his soul that he would always feel. This was a difficult dilemma, and whoever has no understanding for such struggles, and instead moralistically passes judgment on them, is no just writer of history. Close quote. Such struggles, however, when obligations collide, cannot be avoided in the important issues in human life, according to our religious professional. That accounts for the warranted pessimism. Thus, for our religious professional, if we see it clearly, the world absolutely appears in such a way that from the standpoint of nature and from the standpoint of morality, pessimism is fully justified. Our religious professional now turns in his way to religion, and says that he must turn to religion so that all false paths that could be followed will be avoided. Buddhism, he says, tried to avoid the conflicts in life by actually overcoming existence, overcoming physical and spiritual existence, tried to remove them, as our religious professional believes, to unreal nirvana. Plato wanted to remove life conflicts by overcoming matter with knowledge. Our religious professional says that Buddhism wants to do away with all existence, and Platonists want to do away with matter. Mystics, he says, reject individuality. Our religious professional counts as mystics all those in the world, besides those whose ideas have gotten into his head, who assert that they strive to reach the spiritual world. In summary, Buddhists reject existence, Platonists reject matter, mystics reject individuality. None of those are viable paths for our religious professional. Instead, he turns to the path that he naturally sees as the only Christian one. And he says that one must turn away from the earth to the kingdom of God. Then a sort of description follows of this kingdom of God. For those who are able to think in a logical, consistent way, I will make no other demands. For those who have not yet fallen into what I have called discontinuity, the disjointedness of the system of thinking, this description of the kingdom of God by this man of the church brings nothing short of deep pain because of the emptiness, absurdity, and disconnected thinking in it. After this man, like so many people today, has dismissed everything, in quotes, mystical, that is, everything he counts as mystical, he finds a way to fairly, quote, cram words into people's mouths, close quote, forgive the trivial expression, because you get the biggest applause today when you give lots of lectures on things that people do not need to understand. You can say to people that everything else is nonsense, and then they listen to the way you prove to them that it is nonsense, and that no one needs to bother with it. Then, finally, you say, as long as they are still there, true, real existence is love. And then you talk plain nonsense, which is no substance, but which repeats the word love, 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 over and over, repeats it in such a way that in truth no love can come into the world from it. That is more or less the way people of religion speak today. Many people speak that way. And then our religious professional moves on to all kinds of insights, grandiose insights, such as this one, for example, quote, because love is the highest thing, God is love, close quote. Certainly within certain limits, but this is, first of all, not at all new, and second, one can agree with it. But the idea that this has to involve a being that loves, and that can be called love, in quotes, because of loving so intensely, is not really something that causes our religious professional any concern. But now he wants to speak for real Christianity. First of all, God is love means something very impersonal, because love as such is simply impersonal. But our religious professional has no difficulties at all with this, because he says, quote, the center of this reality is God. God is spirit, and God is love. In reality, spirit and love are one. Close quote. We can, in reality, declare everything to be one if we continue in this way of thinking, quote, because love is the highest form of spiritual living, close quote. In truth, spirit and love are one. But at the same time, love is the highest form of spiritual life. Spirit and love are one. But then love is the highest form of spirit. That is a part of it, and the part is the same as the whole. Close quote. Readers aside, there's a quote missing. I think all that I just read, in truth, spirit and love are one, etc., is a quote. And then I closed it. Okay. There you have the worst disconnection in thinking. Now everything that he assumes is based on God being love. Thus, he must also say, quote, when we speak of the wrath of God and his punishments, in the end we must be able to understand it all as an expression of his love, close quote. Now, furthermore, we have the possibility to understand God as love, because the wrath of God is also love, if it is understood correctly. God is spirit, only God is love, spirit and love are one. Wrath is also love, thus wrath must actually also be spirit. Thus we see that the terms are just jumbled in this disjointed thinking. But people will still be Christian, so he finds the need to write in this way, in his way. Quote, thus God can be nothing other than love, because he must be the highest form of spirit. What unfolds here is wisdom that cannot be outdone. Even the highest philosophy cannot go beyond it. God is absolute freedom, the abolition of every conflict, the spirit coming into its own, love. Thus, God is a person. Close quote. So, God is love. This love is the spirit coming into its own, and thus God is person. Quote, when God is given the characteristic of a person, people often dispute it philosophically and religiously, because they say the idea of person comes from the earthly realm and represents humanization when applied to God. But that is a great misunderstanding. Close quote. And so on. You see, what people achieve, which has already fallen into ruin, what one can call disjointedness of thinking, will become widespread as people in their arrogance resist the renewal of the world of thought through the adoption of spiritual science. I would like to quote one more quaint excerpt for you, in order for this religious professional's audience to become completely clear about the fact that they do not need anything other than his lectures, and certainly nothing like science in order to refer to spiritual life. He says to them, quote, it is therefore foolish and senseless to expect from science an answer to the question of life after death. The excited people who have done so and are still doing so have never realized what will become of science if it gets involved with such questions, and what religion loses by borrowing certainty from science. Close quote. This man achieves what I have described to you, and at the same time this man is in the position to say to people that this is such high philosophy that he would lose face if he even admitted that science also has something to say about spiritual life. This is the beginning of everything that is to come, only the beginning. We must also contemplate what I said here 2 weeks ago, but the man I'm talking to you about is a man who, quote, knows how to think, close quote. He accused Buddha of trying to help people get beyond existence. He accused Plato of trying to help people get beyond matter. He accused mystics of trying to help people get beyond individuality, because through them personality would be destroyed. Through them people would be taken out of their physical bodies, in which, as our religious professional says, they would need to remain between birth and death. These redeeming religions cannot be valid. But what does Christian religious belief bring about if it cultivates right love? That is, what the religious professional calls love. Here we read, quote, "In other words, in the spiritual sphere of life of the kingdom of God, awareness is shut out from moral will and action, which takes away the freedom from even our best acts within the realm of our experience." Close quote. So, Plato is trying to free people from matter, Buddha from existence, mystics from individuality, and our religious professional is trying to free people from awareness through love so that they can settle into the kingdom of God without intentional consciousness. When one comes across such people, one says, quote, "The Lord is with his own in sleep," close quote. This could be something of a revelation for our religious professional. One sees that this man can look at life and draw experience from life, but he suffers from disjointed thinking. One can see this when reading painful statements such as these. He turns against people's becoming mystics because such people want to overcome individuality, but they must stand in physical life directly within nature. We must not have misconceptions with regard to life's uncertainties. Quote, "In earthly life they cannot and may not be shaken off," close quote. Things have gone so far with this disjointed thinking that someone with a healthy intellect can say, quote, "In earthly life they cannot and may not be shaken off," close quote. In earthly life they cannot and may not be shaken off, but that is nothing more than saying, quote, "You cannot fly to the moon and you may not," close quote. This is the way he combines can and may here. We must be able to see the great corruption of such thinking in details such as these. Or when the man speaks of inner life, he says that he wants to confine Christian life only to what he calls the kingdom of God. Nature should not be conceived in a spiritual way, because human beings are placed within nature, but they do not know how. And so human beings should stay in nature, though not knowing how they came to be there. Thus he says, quote, "That is for Jesus, the kingdom of God, provided that all symbols and images are stripped from it," close quote. What Jesus said in the form of meaningful symbols and images about the kingdom of God is repugnant to the religious professional. He gets rid of them. Quote, "The highest world is the one Jesus places above the moral world order. It is the one he speaks of unceasingly. People can enter here without giving up their relationship to the order of nature, but also without abandoning their affiliation with the moral world. Everything is transfigured here. The conflict that has arisen between the world of nature and the moral world ends here. It is resolved by love. The relationship of humans to nature is a necessity that we cannot change, and no moral resolve helps here. Human beings must enter the kingdom of nature through birth. No one is asked if he or she wants to be born," close quote. This is the way a religious professional assists people in understanding the world. And then he goes on to say they, human beings, quote, "become forces of a mechanical necessity, forces of a highest mandate, which they do not understand, born into the fate of this physical reality," close quote. That is Christianity. Human beings become, quote, "forces of a mechanical necessity, forces of a highest mandate, which they do not understand," close quote, "born into the physical world." For this man, mechanical necessity, necessity of the machine, is the same as, quote, forces of a highest mandate, close quote. That is expressed, that is spoken in the world today by those who feel called, and who are called by the world to bring true Christianity to the people. And that enters the world in such a way that we can read straight away in the foreword, quote, this little book consists of 12 speeches that I gave last winter to more than 1,000 attendees, close quote. He declined to name the city. It is truly necessary for those of us who seriously wish to study spiritual science to turn our attention to what is actually alive in our time. If the necessity of spiritual science is sometimes alluded to with serious and intense words, it is because the people who are able to must become conscious in the present day of why spiritual science is a requirement of our time, and of what kind of spiritual state exists in the camp where the antagonistic voices come from. Today I quoted a person to you as an example of a general phenomenon of our time. The little book is not explicitly directed against our spiritual science. Spiritual science is not mentioned in it, because it is something highly insignificant to this man, whom I also know personally. Spiritual science is not alluded to, but is just generally lumped in with mysticism. Here we see a person well known as one of the top authorities in his field, who in his system of thinking binds humanity to such nonsense. This is not noticed by thousands upon thousands, because people simply do not look at things in the correct manner. However, individual truths about the spiritual world should not be the only things to permeate us. We must also be permeated by the consciousness of how important this is for living knowledge, living words, to gain ground in the evolution of humanity. People will see that the dead end or impasse into which humanity has come with regard to social life and other areas of life is the karmic result of thoughtlessness. Thoughtlessness is much more extensive in our time than people believe. The task of spiritual science, of understanding in the correct way according to human sensibilities, will depend on people looking at the world with open eyes and really taking pains to form a healthy judgment of the world. Thus it was necessary today not only to say something to you in the first hour of my presentation directly out of the content of spiritual science that can bring enlightenment about important aspects of life, but also to illuminate the counter-image that results if one examines what spiritual science should be brought into. You will hear many voices, such as the one described yesterday, coming from camps of all colors, whether religious, academic, or others, who regard spiritual science as an absurdity, as fantasy. Despite being famous people in our time, they demonstrably cannot think at all, and spread this lack of ability to think to the detriment and harm of the evolution of humanity in the world. We must be able to see these things in the correct light. We are certainly obliged to see them in the correct light if we are to truly connect with spiritual science, in order to do what we are able, according to our place in life that we have been given through karma, and to provide spiritual science in the appropriate way with the validity it requires, not for itself, but for the evolution of humanity. One can see that this is necessary by describing such a counter-image. Many such descriptions could indeed be given. The end of Lecture 5.